Once again, welcome back to another episode of M&A Today. My name is Warren Rose, and I am a senior partner at Grosch Rose and Moore LLC. I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes, not only today, but every Friday at noon Eastern. Thanks for tuning in, and feel free to send me your thoughts, ideas, or questions during the broadcast. And if I don't get to them live on the air, I will respond via email after the show. For everyone listening today, we encourage your involvement and feedback. You can always go back and listen to previous broadcasts that you may have missed or ones that you'd like to hear again. The purpose of this broadcast is to not only educate and inform those of you within the industry, but to give an insight into the advantages of using a professional M&A consulting firm for businesses within the middle market segmentation. Today's broadcast is titled Intangible Asset. So let's begin with a simple definition and go from there. The assets, both tangible and intangible, of a business often represent a very large component of any M&A deal. Additionally, some transactions include large amounts of goodwill, putting the price of both securities and assets well above the typical fair market value. Assessing both tangible and intangible assets in this process has been laid out by the FASB in detail here, and even more recently through publications and statements by the group. Now, the FASB stands for the Financial Accounting Standards Board. It is a private, nonprofit organization, standard-setting body whose primary purpose is to establish and improve generally accepted accounting principles within the United States in the public's interest. The FASB defines intangible assets as assets, not including financial assets, that lack physical substance. In most transactions, we might think of goodwill as such an intangible asset. However, for the purposes of the FASB, an intangible asset does not refer to goodwill. It is everything with the exception of goodwill. The FASB's objective with Statement 142 and the more recent with Topic 350 was to make the recognition of intangibles based more as a reflection of actual business operation, thus separating goodwill from all the other operational intangible assets of the business. So let's first look at how intangibles are recognized by an acquirer in an M&A deal. When such an intangible asset is acquired as part of some sort of business combination, it is necessary the acquirer separate the asset from goodwill if, and there's 2 points here, if it arises from a legal or contractual right, and it is actually separable. So separable means that the acquirer is able to parse or divide the asset outside of the target business and potentially sell, rent, license, or exchange it to another company or entity. A legal right or some form of contractual obligation may give rise to an intangible asset even if it cannot be separated, sold, or transferred. A separable asset is always defined in this case as intangible, even if the acquirer does not intend to subsequently or separately divest of the asset after the overall transaction is completed. Now let's look at some prime examples of intangibles. The first one is patent or IP expiring in 15 years. Because patents and IP are a legal right, regardless of whether or not there is an intent to sell, they are by definition an intangible asset. Next, we have customer lists. Such customer lists may not represent a legal right, but they are separable as a part of a business combination. Thus, they are considered an intangible asset. Next, we have employee 5-year non-compete agreements. Because such an agreement is based on a contractual right, it is an intangible asset. The one exception would be at-will employee contracts, unless an employment agreement is in place. Next, we have tech that is unpatentable. Because technology is separable, regardless of the ability to claim so as a legal right, it is considered an intangible asset. A specific example could include software coding that is not patented, but is an asset that could easily be transferred. In the event that an asset acquired during an M&A transaction does not qualify as an intangible based on these definitions, the asset will then be included as goodwill. All right, let's dive into the topic of goodwill for a bit and again start with the definition. What is goodwill? Well, goodwill is an intangible asset that is associated with the purchase of one company by another. Specifically, goodwill is recorded in a situation in which the purchase price is higher than the sum of the fair value of all identifiable tangible and intangible assets purchased in the acquisition and the liabilities assumed in the process. The value of a company's brand name, solid customer base, good customer relations, good employee relations, and any patents or proprietary technology represent some examples of goodwill. So what are the key takeaways here? Well, goodwill is an intangible asset that accounts for the excess purchase price of another company based upon its proprietary or intellectual property, brand recognition, patents, etc., which is not easily quantifiable. Next, companies are required to evaluate the value of goodwill on their financial statements at least once a year and record any impairments. And finally, a takeaway is goodwill is a very different item from other intangible assets, having an indefinite life, while other intangible assets have a definite useful life. Next, let's look at how goodwill is calculated for M&A. The excess of the purchase price of the target business over a fair market value of the net assets is known as acquired goodwill. When determining the net assets, the acquirer will look at both tangible and intangible assets, including goodwill, less assumed liabilities. In short, goodwill is the total of intangibles that do not meet the separation requirements previously discussed. In short form, goodwill equals assets, both tangible and intangible, minus existing goodwill, minus assumed liabilities. Okay, now I'd like to discuss intangible treatment for M&A. If we're following the rules laid out by the FASB, there are four requisite steps when it comes to the treatment of intangibles when a business combination occurs. Number one, the acquirer must recognize separable and thus qualifying intangibles at their fair market value, which is also called FMV. FMV is typically estimated at what the asset could be bought or sold for in the open market between two willing and reasonable parties, not necessarily the price for which the asset could be liquidated. Number two, the useful economic life of the asset must be estimated. This is the length of time the asset is expected to contribute to future cash flows of the business. Once the economic life of the asset is complete, no value is assumed unless particular criteria are met. Number three, in each reporting period, the acquirer will deduct the amortization expense against the intangible asset in each period. This is typically done in straight-line fashion, unless, of course, there's some other method that better reflects the reality of the amortization. throughout the useful life of the asset, and in each reporting period, the acquiring firm must evaluate the remaining useful life of the asset to determine the reasonableness of the original economic life assumption. And finally, number four, regular impairment tests must also occur when any indication comes to light that might indicate any of the assets have been impaired. Timing on impairment tests for useful life of an asset is different from the timing for goodwill or for any intangible asset with an indefinite life. Assets with a finite life, both tangible and intangible, as well as goodwill, are typically assessed annually for impairment and may be marked down due to the lower cost or FMV. So, if the useful economic life of an intangible asset is found to be of an indefinite timeline, the acquirer will be required to test the asset for impairment on an annual basis and sometimes even more often. Write-downs on the asset only occur when the comparison between book value and the FMV of the asset yields a negative spread. Now, please note, much of what I've been talking about here is within the realm of a larger, complex, and public transactions. In addition, please note this information does not constitute accounting, tax, legal, or investment advice. You need to seek knowledge help when performing complex business transactions. All right, I get to take a break here and tell you a few things about our firm, Grosch, Rose & Moore, LLC. We have always believed that our client approach sets us apart from our competition. First and foremost, we listen, and then we take that knowledge leveraged by our experience and vast contacts to create the right fit. We then focus on what is important to you, your business, and any shareholders. We also strive to conduct ourselves in a manner that makes certain everyone is treated fairly and equitably. Really, regardless of who you contract with and what they do, you need an M&A advisory firm that not only has knowledge and experience to get things done, but understands and cares about your business goals. So if you were looking to buy, sell, consolidate, form a strategic alliance, get a business valuation or consultation, call me at 303-941-7865 or email me at wrose@grosch-rose-moore.com. Bottom line, we only want a fee if we've earned it. Whether it's on the buy or the sell side, no deal, no fee. It's really that simple. Since we've been talking about intangible assets, I thought we should discuss what is calculated intangible value. And sometimes you'll see this just simply referred to as CIV. I mean, now that we've identified what the intangible assets are, we need to know what they're worth, right? Well, calculated intangible value is a method of valuing a company's intangible assets. This calculation attempts to allocate a fixed value to intangible assets that won't change according to the company's market value. An intangible asset is a non-physical asset. Examples include what we've talked about before. They can include patents, trademarks, copyrights, goodwill, brand recognition, customer lists, and proprietary technology. Because an intangible asset has no physical form and isn't easily converted to cash, calculating its value can be very challenging. However, there are times when calculating the value of intangible assets becomes critical. For example, owners looking to sell their company may hire a business appraiser to specifically value the company's intangible assets. So, what are the key takeaways here? Well, a calculated intangible value, CIV, is a method of valuing a company's intangible assets, which again are assets that are not physical in nature. And remember, we talked about this before. I can't impress upon you enough how many things may be included in that. That includes the brand recognition, goodwill, patents, trademarks, copyrights, the proprietary technology, and your customer lists. Another key takeaway is that the CIV takes into consideration factors such as the company's pre-tax earnings, a company's average return on tangible assets, and the industry's average return on tangible assets. Next, let's understand calculated intangible value. Frequently, a company's intangible assets are valued by subtracting a firm's book value from its market value. However, opponents of this method argue that because market value constantly changes, the value of intangible assets also changes, making it an inferior measure. On the other hand, the calculated intangible value takes additional factors into consideration, such as company's pre-tax earnings, the company's average return on those tangible assets, and the industry's average return on tangible assets. This might be worth going back to the recorded broadcast and listening to this again. You really need to understand CIV, especially if you're trying to value your business for an acquisition or possible takeover. So, that being said, let's look at determining the calculated intangible value. Finding a company's CIV involves seven steps. Number one, calculate the average pre-tax earnings for the past 3 years. Number two, calculate the average year-end tangible assets for the past 3 years. Number three, calculate the company's return on assets. Number four, calculate the industry average ROA for the same 3 year period as in step two. Number five, calculate excess ROA by multiplying the industry average ROA by the average tangible assets calculated in step two. Subtract the excess return from the pre-tax earnings from step one. This is a rather complicated step, so let me repeat that for you. This is number five in the seven steps. And remember, you can go back and listen to this on the recorded broadcast. Number five again, calculate excess return on assets by multiplying the industry average return on assets by the average tangible assets calculated in step two. Then subtract the excess return from the pre-tax earnings from step one. Okay, on to number six. Calculate the 3 year average corporate tax rate and multiply by the excess return. Then deduct the result from the excess return. Finally, number seven, calculate the net present value, NPV, of the after-tax excess return. Use the company's cost of capital as a discount rate. Okay, the bottom line here. It is much easier to calculate an accurate value for tangible assets than intangible assets. Tangible assets such as product inventory, buildings, land, and equipment are visible and simple to understand. Because intangible assets are more difficult to value, companies may choose to hire a third-party business evaluator or an appraiser to perform the intricate task of identifying the company's unique assets and placing a value on them. When a company is for sale, this process becomes more critical as questions regarding asset value can lead to disputes between the buyer and seller. Despite the valuation difficulties posed by intangible assets, these assets can play a huge role in the company's success. Apple, for example, has spent considerable money and time to develop its primary proprietary technology and brand recognition, which can be seen in the company's product design, logos, packaging, and slogans, all of which impact Apple's ability to generate profits and sales. Okay, we still have time today to address a question that's relative. We received this earlier this week from Gary, who is a longtime listener of the show, and Gary asks, can you address the difference between the book value versus market value of a business? I'd be happy to do that, Gary, and as a matter of fact, I briefly touched on those terms earlier in covering of the topic, understanding calculated intangible value, but we can definitely drill down on that a little deeper. So, book value versus market value. Let's start with a basic overview. Valuing a listed company is a fairly complex task, and several different measures are used to arrive at a fair valuation. While none of the methods is precise and each presents a different version with varying results, investors use them in combination to get a good understanding of how stocks have performed. Two most commonly used quantifiable measures for valuing a company are market value and book value. So we'll start out by comparing the two popular factors, their differences, and how they can be used in analyzing companies. Let's start with book value. Well, book value literally means the value of a business according to the books or its accounts. That is reflected through all of its financial statements. Theoretically, book value represents the total amount a company is worth if all of its assets are sold and all of the liabilities are paid back. This is the amount that the company's creditors and investors can expect to receive if the company is liquidated. Mathematically, book value is calculated as the difference between a company's total assets and total liabilities. There are, of course, limitations of book value. One of the major issues with book value is that the figure is reported quarterly or annually. It is only after the reporting that an investor would know how the company's book value has changed over the preceding period. Book value is an accounting item and is subject to adjustments such as depreciation, which may not be easy to understand and assess. If the company has been depreciating its assets, one may need to check several years of financial statements to understand its impact. Additionally, due to depreciation-linked rules of accounting practices, a company may be forced to report a higher value of its equipment, though its value may have gone down. Book value may also not consider the realistic impact of claims on its assets, like those for loans. The book valuation may be different than the real value if the company is a bankruptcy candidate and has several liens against its assets. Book value is not very useful for businesses relying heavily on human capital. Now let's go to market value. The market value represents the value of a company according to the stock market. While market value is a generic term that represents the price of an asset or the company itself would get in the marketplace, it represents the market capitalization in the context of companies. It is the aggregate market value of a company represented as a dollar amount. Since it represents the market value of a company, it is computed based on the current market price, CMP, of its shares. That's an important point, so let's just go over that again. Since it represents the market value of a company, it is computed based on the current market price of its shares. Now let's get to market value formula. Market value, also known as market cap, is calculated by multiplying a company's outstanding shares by its current market price. Market value does have its limitations, though. While market cap represents the market perception of a company's valuation, it may not necessarily represent the true picture. it is common to see even mega cap or large cap stocks moving 3 to 5% up or down during a day's session. A stock often gets overbought or oversold, and relying solely on market cap valuations may not be the best method to assess a stock's realistic potential. So let's take a quick look at book value and market value use. Most publicly listed companies fulfill their capital needs through a combination of debt and equity. Debt is raised by taking loans from banks and other financial institutions or by floating interest-paying corporate bonds. Equity capital is raised by listing shares on the stock exchange through an initial public offering known as an IPO or through other measures such as follow-on issues, rights issues, and additional share sales. Debt capital requires payment of interest as well as repayment of the loaned money to creditors. However, equity capital has no such obligation for the company, as equity investors aim for dividend income or capital gains emerging from fluctuations in the stock prices. Creditors who provide the necessary capital to the business are interested in the company's asset value, as they are much more concerned about repayment. Book value is used by creditors to determine how much capital to lend to the company, since assets are typically used as collateral, or to determine a company's ability to pay back the loan over a given period of time. On the other hand, investors and traders are more interested in timely buying or selling of a stock at a fair price. Market value, when used in comparison with other measures, including book value, provides a fair idea of whether the stock is fairly valued, overvalued, or undervalued. I've got a few moments here to spotlight a company that we're working with right now that's really interesting. You can find out more about this by going to our website or contacting me for additional details. This is actually something I enjoy doing. This is a beverage brands consolidation investment opportunity. And basically what it is taking four different beverage brands and consolidating them under one corporate moniker. It'll be under the umbrella of one single company. So we're taking four companies and putting them together as one separate entity. In 2020, they're estimated to have a revenue of close to $25 million. It's almost close to $10 million in net income. Now, a little forward thinking on this, 2023, they project their revenue to be over $100 million. With almost $41 million of net income. These four beverage brands are in niche segments, which are basically outperforming traditional mass market offerings right now. It's a US-based headquarter business. It's really a unique opportunity. And by consolidating these four brands, this group will rapidly reduce expenditures and increase profits through economies to scale, and eliminating redundant expenses within management, production, distribution, marketing, and supply side purchases. Also, needed brand extensions are also a part of the strategically engineered business plan. Go to our website, take a look at that, or contact me for additional details. Well, we're running out of time today, so I want to thank everyone for tuning in again today. Please join us next week, and we'll continue to explore events and processes within our industry and then provide you with valuable interpretation of what that means to you and your business. Thanks again for tuning in to M&A Today. I'll talk to you guys next Friday at noon Eastern.